Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam Stasekel, joined as always by Paul Tenorio, and we are coming to you on our regularly scheduled time slot, recording on a Thursday. We're not recording at 2 in the morning after U.S. Men's National Team World Cup qualifier. We're back in kind of MLS, American Soccer, USMNT, like mashup land, the space that we usually kind of occupy on this show. And Paul, we got one of our like little Christmas gifts in our little weird, bizarre world that we live in. Earlier this week, when the MLS Players Association released the updated list of players' salaries for the 2021 season, they, of course, released a list earlier this year. April 15th, I believe, was the release date. So that was right before the season began. There have been a significant number of new signings and new contracts to current players, holdover players, since then. So a lot of new information, both in terms of how much teams are spending and how much players are making and all of that stuff. So we're going to dive in on that today. And we're going to answer a few listener questions as well that we solicited on Twitter from that topic. So yeah, that's what's on tap. Paul, I don't know. Did you dive into these numbers? You're sort of working. You're sort of not working. So, you know, I don't know how much time you spent in that spreadsheet, but, you know, yeah, we're going to put you on the spot. I guess we're going to find out on this show.
I don't know if I should go public with the fact that I'm on like a quasi paternity leave, considering the recent paternity leave controversy.
Was there a controversy?
Yeah, there were some politicians that were saying that paternity leave is for a certain subset of weak men to use, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly
if the shoe fits.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't trade in any of the time I've had to spend with my two kids for, you know, for example, writing this salary story with you. As much as I love writing these salary stories, the world has gone on with it not being a joint byline. Sam, you're more than capable of doing this story yourself. And so capable are you of doing the story that, yeah, I dove into it through reading your story, your breakdown, your analysis.
All right. Okay.
You see, I made it work there, Sam.
Yeah. Way to bring it around.
Yeah. I mean, I took a look at it and, you know, again, not a massive amount of updates necessarily. It's not as big as the initial drop when we learned a ton about the teams, but I think we have a much better picture of where the spending has happened now this year. The teams who have spent a ton and are underperforming, the teams who have spent very little and are performing well, you know, the players who are paid too much or in some cases maybe too little. I don't think there are very many of those cases in Major League Soccer.
There used to be a lot of those.
Yeah, there's
by the
not
way.
So many. Not so many now. And you know, I don't know, maybe we can dive in there, Sam, because I think you before we started the show proposed kind of an interesting thought, you know, exercise on that. That's kind of like every time I pull up these numbers, those are the things I'm looking for, is which teams spent too much money or, you know, spent the most money, and which teams, which players are making too much money or making too little. I don't know. I feel like it's like MLS is getting better at not paying guys too little.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the wages at the bottom go up significantly in recent years, for sure. Part of that is CBA related. Part of it is just kind of market related, particularly with a lot of these homegrown products. You know, you have to pay them to not go to college, essentially, or pay them to stop them from signing a European contract when they turn 18, and all of those different things. So, yeah, I would have to go through one by one to get a really accurate feel for like what percentage of players are like appropriately compensated, or if you eliminated professional soccer from the United States and Canada entirely, and you took every player in MLS and said, okay, go sign with a team elsewhere in the world, are you going to be within 5% of the salary that you're making currently in this league? Like, what number is that? I don't know. I would say probably pretty low, Paul.
Yeah, like, you and I both landed on the same number. Let's be honest. Before we recorded, we both said 10% without knowing that the other one said that. So, you know, why? Because we know that the DPs here, you kind of have to overspend on DPs to get them to come to Major League Soccer. That's just the reality of the market, the reality of a growing league trying to convince players in their prime to come here,
gotta pay a premium.
Players to come here. You pay a premium. So most of those guys that come to this league are overpaid.
And that trickles down, by the way. That's the same for TAM players. If you're convincing a player who's playing in, say, a Big Five league in Europe, who's 27 years old in the heart of his prime, hey, come to MLS, you're going to have to pay him more than he would otherwise make in Europe. Like, 100%.
It also sometimes is a consideration of bad negotiating. I think there are some GMs, I shouldn't say some. I spoke to one person who felt like MLS teams don't do a good enough job of negotiating. They don't take fully into consideration what the players are making in their home countries or in their previous contracts, and they start too high on that negotiation. They factor in that premium to too high of a degree in order to kind of shorten the negotiation and get the player in, and they don't think about the consequences of that negotiation, especially in terms of resale value and obviously the impact on the greater market in general. But, you know, again, so I think the very, very top of the league, the top like 20, 30 players, you have a chart here. I would say probably the top 20 of those players are probably making significantly more, most of them. You know, like Nani at 2.5 million, would he probably maybe be making that in Europe? I could see him making that. But, you know, others, no. Frank O'Hara, $3 million, where is he going to get that? You know? So there's a give and take here, but I would say the top part, I think the bottom portion, especially when you look at homegrown players, we hear this all the time, Sam. I think I can speak for both of us, that young homegrown players are making way more money on their first contracts than they would make almost anywhere in the world. That, you know, unless you're signing a reserve deal with a Bundesliga or Premier League team, and not a youth deal, a reserve deal, the money that's being offered in MLS is pretty darn good for these players, especially when you compare it to South America, when you compare it to Central America, when you compare it to the lower divisions in Europe. You know, guys making six figures on their first homegrown deal, you know, that's
unheard of.
That's pretty unheard of. It's pretty significant money. So you know, when you take that, and then I think we have to acknowledge that there's a whole chunk of American players who have far more value in this league than they would have elsewhere, and far more options in this league than they would have elsewhere. So if you eliminated the league, that's why the percentage gets so big, because the very best MLS players domestically are probably not going to the best leagues in Europe, all of them. And so immediately you get hit with going to countries like Austria or Denmark or Norway, where the median salary is significantly lower. And so that's why you and I landed on such a low number of people that would fall within 5%.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, though, asked by not by us, but by a media member who shall remain anonymous for his own protection. You all are free to guess who it may have been, but we'll never tell. So it's an interesting question. Winding it back a little bit, let's just kind of highlight some of the actual numbers that have been updated. We have a new entry into the top five highest paid players in the league. Luis Araujo. I butchered that. Araujo? It's not Araujo. I don't know, man.
I'm just going to let you
think. I'm a sad boy.
I'm just going to stay over here and
just
let you
think.
I'm sorry.
That was terrible. Joe, edit this out.
Don't do it, Joe.
Don't edit it out. Just, you know, we got to embrace it.
Sam,
anyway,
what's great is that
new guy
that
Atlanta signed, who's from Brazil.
From Sam Stasekel.
Luis Araujo, that's what I'm going to call him, even though that's incorrect. He is the fifth highest paid player in MLS. He's got a guaranteed compensation of $3.94 million for 2021, annualized for 2021, which not only is fifth highest in MLS, but is highest on Atlanta United, just $5,000 ahead of Joseph Martinez, who ranks sixth in the league. Kind of interesting that you know, he would be $5,000 ahead of Joseph Martinez. Yeah, kind of makes you like raise an eyebrow.
Almost to make sure he wanted to be, you know, you're fulfilling a promise that you'd be the highest paid player on the team. And of course, these numbers don't include bonuses for goals scored and things like that.
Per matches,
which I'm sure Joseph Martinez has baked into his deal, considering his prowess of scoring in MLS. I also want to note that he's actually not the fifth highest paid player in MLS. He's the sixth highest paid player in MLS.
True.
Because Blaise Matuidi is listed as making exactly $1.5 million, you know, on the head. We know that that's not correct. We know that he's making north of $5 million a year, based on what Jorge Mas told me in an interview. So he is actually the fourth highest paid player in MLS, Matuidi, which knocks everyone down one peg from what we see in these numbers.
Otherwise, the top 10 remains the same. Carlos Vela at the top, Javier Hernandez, Chicharito, Gonzalo Higuain, then Matuidi, technically, Alejandro Pozuelo, Luis Araujo, Joseph Martinez, Jozy Altidore, Rodolfo Pizarro, Maxi Morales, Victor Wanyama. Paul, that's not a very impressive list of names. All of those, I mean, there are some big names in there, certainly, but in terms of production, not good value. And then you get to the next guy on the list, Carles Hill, likely MVP. That's the first real name on this list that's like, okay, that guy's really, really producing in a big way this year. I guess Maxi Morales has had some good play as well. So I don't mean to besmirch everybody on that list, but it's been a rough year for the production for the highest paid players in MLS.
You know, we were on a staff call earlier today, and I didn't pipe up in this moment because Ben, my son, was in my arms crying, and I couldn't unmute myself. But you know, there was a discussion about the kind of lack of star power in the production this year. I think overall, in general, in Major League Soccer, and I think that's pretty accurate. You know, the spending at the very top has been significant, but without a ton of production comparatively to what we've seen in past years. I think that happens in part because you have older players who are kind of being reintroduced to these highest spending lists, specifically with what Miami did. And then, you know, also
injuries,
I want to give credit.
Injuries.
Yeah, and injuries as well, of course, have played a role when you look at
Vela's
especially
missed
at
Vela, a lot of time.
Jozy Altidore,
Joseph Martinez,
Joseph
Chicharito
Martinez.
Has been.
Chicharito's missed time.
Chicharito's been good, but he hasn't played a ton. Yeah.
So, you know, you factor those in, but I think there is a valid point here in that right now, when you look at DP spending, it's almost as if the vast majority of the attention on spending has turned towards different areas, right? Finding efficiency in TAM, finding efficiency in the U22 market, and there hasn't been as much attention paid to those highest pay, sorry, that more teams are spending in that area of, you know, somewhere around 12 or so on this list and down, 3 million and less. You know, you look at some of the names that are down there, Nico Ladero, Sebastian Drusi, Adrian Hunau, Gaston Jimenez, guys who have come in the last 2 years who are all right around those numbers. There are some older players here as well that have been around that number. But I think that factors in here. When you look at where that big money is being spent, it's still kind of on the teams outside of Araujo. I don't know. I'll try my best there, Sam.
It's better than me.
Outside of him as a new signing, you know, most of these guys that are up here are kind of guys who have been around a couple years or older players. And you know, Pozuelo was very productive last year, obviously. Not so much this year. But I think we're maybe starting to see a trend where we're partway through of decreased spending on salary on the top DPs. And that, you know, I think we could see a change here in the top six or seven next year in that, you know, Vela might be gone. Chicharito will be here. Higuain certainly seems like they're praying that he's going to retire in Miami based on the interview I read the other day with in the Sun. You know, Joseph Martinez is not going anywhere. Jozy Altidore, he could be out as a DP. Pizarro could be out as a DP. I just wonder if we start to see kind of a switch in where those numbers land salary-wise.
I don't agree with like almost anything you said there.
Good.
I'm not really sure what point you were trying to make. Maybe you're a little sleep deprived here, but I think that spending I mean, on average on these DPs, they're probably way... This is just a hunch. I haven't gone and done the math. I would imagine there are way more players making more than $2 million now than ever before in MLS.
Yes. All I'm saying is that I think we're going to see fewer players above $3 million than we've seen in the past.
I mean, I think I would say the same thing about $3 million players as well. Like, right now, we have 11 players, 12 when you count Matuidi, making more than $3 million a year in guaranteed compensation. And Frank O'Hara is at 2.977. So you're almost add one more on there. I would be very surprised if there was ever a time in MLS history where that number was higher. And I don't think that's going to change. I think it'll probably be pretty linear growth in the future. You're right that maybe at the top, the top, right? Carlos Vela, highest paid, $6.3 million a year. Right, I don't remember exactly what like Javinko was on or Robbie Keane, but I imagine it was in that neighborhood. Right, so the highest paid, that ceiling seems relatively defined. Right, Zlatan was what, 7.2.
So was Kaká.
Yeah. So like we haven't really gone above that, right? And I don't think necessarily we will anytime here in the near future. But I think we'll continue to see guys signed for above $3 million.
I don't know. I'm not saying we're not going to see guys sign for above $3 million. I think the profile of
players. You did kind of just.
I think
say
we're going to see fewer guys signed at those big money numbers. I think unless MLS teams alter, I think there's going to be a fear factor here of signing guys like Higuain and even Vela, who was brilliant and an MVP, but has played like 25 games over 2 years. Mm-hmm. To give and Chicharito, who was terrible last year and has been okay this year, that yeah. There's going to be a little bit more of a fear and a hesitation from owners to go spend significant money on older stars.
Yeah,
Araujo,
God, Luis, he's 25, he's making $4 million.
Right?
Why not more of that?
Again, I think when you look at anyone who's made $5 million. Plus, I think the exception would be Jovinko, and I don't think he was on that on his first contract, but he might have been. He might have been the one big exception. Those huge numbers have been guys of the Vela profile, of Ibrahimovic, of Kaká, known names on more toward the back end of their career. I don't want to group Vela in necessarily with Kaká. That's not really fair. He was certainly younger than... Kaká was 32 when he signed in MLS?
I think Vela was in his 20s when he signed
in
MLS.
So, sure. I just think that the profile will change at the bare minimum. Like, if we're going to see players signed at $4 million plus, $5 million plus, it's going to be, I think the focus is going to be on trying to find the next Jovinkos, like the in the prime stars. And with one exception, Inter Miami. I don't think David Beckham changes his model at all. I think he'll continue to
but
chase.
But, Paul, this is what it is now.
Not really.
Right.
Like, I think LAFC doesn't go with the... I don't know, man. I mean, maybe. Maybe I'm just crazy. I just feel like I think you're going to see a lot more focus from more MLS teams on finding guys that fit in that $2 to $3 million range. And we're seeing that right now. Like, you scroll down this list, and the number of $2 million players is essentially the top 30 players are all right around $2 million. That's definitely got to be way more than it used to be. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think especially when you start to, you know... I think you're going to start to see more MLS teams who are lower budget shooting to have DPs in that range and fewer guys who are like low money, quote unquote, DPs. I just think that I don't know. I think that we're going to see less salary spend at the very top and more transfer money spend overall. Like, I think there's going to be a slight shift there.
Okay. That I can get behind. I just think we're already kind of there. I think it's already happened and it'll kind of continue to happen. And I think there's always going to be a few older, bigger name guys making a ton of money in this league. And I think that isn't going to change anytime soon. And I think that's fine. And I think most of the teams, as they are now, are going to be looking for those guys in their primes who might not be making quite as much money, but are still making a ton of money. I think that's been the model for a while, and I think it will continue to be so. Moving on a little bit, other newcomers to crack the top 30 in salary beyond the Atlanta signing. I can't even say it. I'm afraid of his name. Sebastian Drewsi from Austin FC. He's making 2.7, roughly. He's 15th or 16th, depending on how you count Matuidi. Adrian Hunu Who knew? Making $2.58 million. He has not delivered on that salary just yet. The striker from Minnesota United, Ryan Gauld, Vancouver's long sought after number 10, who has been very good for the Whitecaps since he arrived earlier this summer. He's just north of $2 million. And Jefferson Soteldo, Toronto FC, he was signed, I think, right after the list came out in the spring. He's been here basically all year. He is just south of $2 million. Been up and down for him as well, in a difficult year for Toronto FC. Other news in terms of players, and I think we'll stick with players here, and then we can shift to teams in the next segment, Paul. I don't know if that sounds good. Ake Loba, Nashville, another notable one, $1.3 million. Another one that is not, you know, still early days, but he has not hit returns on that at all so far. Talas Magno, New York City FC, he's about $1.2 million. Again, hasn't really produced thus far in MLS. And then a couple of guys who have been in the league for years and got new contracts. Eduard Atuesta got a massive bump all the way up to $1.3 million for LAFC. He signed an extension in May. Tim Parker signed an extension in the summer, center back for the Houston Dynamo. He bumped from about, I think, $850,000 to $1.2 million. This is a wild note. The Houston Dynamo signed three of the four highest paid center backs in the league to their deals. Number one, Al Jazz, Kiki Struna. Tim Parker, number two. Jonathan Mensah, the lone non-Dynamo signee in this equation, is number three, highest paid center back. And number four is Teenage Hadebe, formerly of Chicken Inn FC, the designated player signing that they had earlier this summer. That's wild. I mean, I've been talking here for a while, Paul, but I could spend a few minutes on that by itself. If you're signing a center back for that much money, which isn't necessarily a thing you should be doing, by the way, especially if you're not paying other people more money than that, which is pretty much the case for Houston. They need to be Defender of the Year caliber players, and that is not what those three are. So,
yeah, not the most efficient. Continue. Not the most efficient spend, we could say, for the Dynamo.
Yeah, not the greatest. But so those are some of the notable players. Tati Castellanos also got a big raise. Ricardo Pepi got a significant raise, but he's still under 300,000, if I'm remembering correctly. Julian Araujo, pronounced that one correctly. Same spelling, different pronunciation. And Efra Alvarez, two young players for the LA Galaxy. They also got big raises and are young money players now. So a couple of interesting notes there. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back with some team talk in the next segment.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Welcome back to Allocation Disorder. We are dissecting the MLS salary release, the MLS salary dump that the Players Union put out earlier this week. We just talked about players and which are making the most money in MLS. Now it's time to talk about teams, which frankly I think is a little bit more interesting personally, Paul. LA Galaxy, they were number three when the spring numbers came out. They are now number one. Atlanta United, number two in overall payroll. Toronto FC, number three. Miami, number four. LAFC, number five. NYCFC, six. Columbus, number seven. Although with that caveat that if you count Blaise Matuidi properly, Miami would be first in this race. Paul, I have a question for you. Do you know what five of those top seven teams have in common?
They are not in the playoffs.
That is correct. Pretty massive disappointment, I think it's fair to say. And to be fair, this doesn't account for all spend right? This doesn't account for transfer fees. It doesn't count for acquisition costs. That's a significant chunk of change. But these top seven teams, with possibly the exception of Columbus, all of them spend significantly on transfer fees. So they're probably the top of the table, even when you include acquisition costs. And pretty much all of them have been disappointments this year, even including those above the playoff line. I guess the Galaxy, you know, they're bouncing back after a couple of hard years, but they haven't been great. Atlanta United has been very up and down, although they're doing pretty well at the moment. But neither of those teams are sure things to even make the playoffs. So it's pretty remarkable how poorly the teams at the top of the payroll list are playing. It's a wild, wild thing, and it's not something that we see really in any other leagues around the world. This is just an MLS thing. And, you know, if we go down further on the table, Colorado having an excellent year, third in the West, they have the smallest payroll in MLS. New England Revolution might set the all-time points record in the league, 20th payroll in the league, right? So it's just kind of a wild thing. What do you make of this, Paul, the fact that wages don't seem to correlate to results whatsoever in MLS?
Yeah, Sam, I think basically this is just highlighting the issues that MLS has with its pay structure, right? You know, wage bills around the world show a collective balance. Like the big difference between MLS and Liga MX is that the amount of money being spent is spread over a larger portion of the roster. And what we know in Major League Soccer is that a huge percentage of spend is on the top three players on a roster. So if you get one or two of those players wrong, or if one or two of those players get injured, chances are your team is going to struggle, because not only are those your best players, but your team has pretty much been structured around those players. So when you look at Miami and Blaise Matuidi and Higuain and Pizarro struggling, that's how much does that make up of their entire total spend? Like an enormous percentage.
Yeah.
You know, same.
I mean, like probably at least 50.
Oh, at least. You know, at least. Same with Toronto FC. You know, if you're not getting the production out of your DPs, and we can show definitely that they're not this year. One of them injured. Pozuelo's been injured. Soteldo's struggled. You know, the results are going to be poor in part because, well, I think Toronto's a little bit different in that they might have they might be due for kind of a makeover, but you know, the team is structured around those DPs.
Right.
And so
LAFC
is another example of
another
that.
Example.
Vela is kind of built, they built the team around him. And so, you know, that's why I think you can have years like this where when things start to go wrong on these teams and those things are going wrong centered on the DPs, it's going to show that the spend is not efficient. And that's not a spend is not efficient just on an individual basis of each team and each player, but the league-wide spend. That, you know, the highest spending teams are spending that money on three specific players. And when you look at the teams who are doing well that have kind of balanced rosters, you look at New England, Colorado, Philadelphia, those teams are,
Seattle
is maybe the exception. You know, I want to group them differently than Philly, Colorado, New England. Those teams are getting the most out of every single dollar they spend. You know, in the case of Philadelphia, they were in the past leaning on homegrowns, but it's about efficiency of spend. Everyone's around the same level and no one is the kind of centerpiece of the team. Same with New England, same with Colorado.
New England's
a little bit different in that they, you know, they have two DPs and one.
They
who
paid
became,
transfer fees.
You know, a bigger player. But so maybe New England fits more with Seattle than I give it credit for. But look, if you look at the rest of the roster, the way that they built that roster, it wasn't built as we are a team with stars and then plan B. Though, you know, we saw what happened when the one star was injured last year with New England, when their best player was injured. It was harder.
They were good, but it was harder.
They weren't doing what they did this year. Seattle has been incredibly good.
And they're sort of the exception, right? Because Nico Ladero and Jordan Morris have missed almost all of this year. And they're still first in the West.
Yeah. And I just think that, again, it's just about like how do you spread that spend out? And can those other players in the roster, if you've hit on those mid-level guys, can they make up for the loss of the big stars? That's ultimately the question in Major League Soccer. And if you haven't built the rest of the roster correctly, it falls apart pretty quickly. And you can look at Miami as an example of that. You can look at Chicago as an example of that. Toronto as an example of that. If you're missing on your TAM guys and your guys making 400K and you don't have homegrown players who are bringing up the back end and way outperforming their salaries, it gets very hard to make up for missing your DPs or not having your DPs on the field.
Yep, 100%. I did a little bit of what I thought was an interesting exercise, and Paul, this has some relevance to you personally here. But wages spent per point earned in 2021. The Revs, no surprise, they have way more points than anybody else in the league. They're spending the fewest, roughly $177,000 per point spent, or per point earned. Colorado, closely behind, then Philly, then Seattle. And then, Paul, your New York Red Bulls, the team you picked to finish second in the Eastern Conference. If you go by this, they are second or third, excuse me, in the Eastern Conference in dollars spent per point at right around 250K per point. So there you go. Little bit of saving grace
sure.
for you.
I mean, the math will get a little different for New England, to your point, Seattle, New York, when you add in transfer fees paid for the roster as constructed. Though I would say Seattle probably not so if you amortize the spend over the number of years. Rui Diaz has been there for a long time.
Which I think you would have to.
Yeah. So
yeah, you would have
but,
to do that.
But certainly New England's math would be different. You know, I think Colorado and Philly would jump ahead of New England, you know, once you factor in transfer
fees. Doubt.
So credit to those teams.
Well, those teams don't pay transfer fees essentially. Colorado especially.
Yeah. So
it's not a thing that happens out there.
Right. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's just hard. I think it's just hard in MLS to spend efficiently. The system itself is designed to not do that. Sam, you were the person for a long time pounding the desk on the inefficiency of TAM, that, you know, it was literally a system built to be inefficient. And
the dead zone
that it created. Now that started to change as with the new CBA, they're going to start winding down TAM and winding up GAM to try to fix that inefficiency. And we've immediately seen players now getting paid between $400,000 and $500,000.
Got to be careful when you wind up that GAM.
Right. So, yeah. But it's just the league itself, all these pots create natural inefficiencies. And, you know, I think, I don't know, I'm biased, I think, in kind of what I've talked about a lot on the show and in conversations with people around the league, Sam, certainly with you. But I think being able to maximize MLS talent, finding guys in this league who are undervalued, that you don't have to pay transfer fees for, or you're paying a significantly lower cost in the trade market than you would internationally, and valuing those players correctly when you're building your roster gives you a huge chance to be closer to Colorado and Philadelphia and Montreal this year versus Montreal in past years than it does to being the teams who rely too heavily on international signings and thus, you know, are gambling far more because you don't know what you're going to get. And that's where I think that's where I think Bruce Arena has been so good. He's always been incredible back at the Galaxy and now with New England at finding players like in New England this year, Matt Polster and Tommy McNamara, that profile that
Mike McGee in the past,
yeah. Juninho, who wasn't an MLS guy, but you know, then he was all of a sudden, right? And he kind of fit in a little box and he was like, you are good at this one thing and I'm going to put you in there and tell you to do just this one thing and that's going to be good enough for this team. And like, that's what he does really well. And I think that's where a lot of the other MLS teams struggle is that they don't see those players, the Mike McGee's, the Matt Polster's, as having value compared to what maybe this guy could be, right? Matt Polster's ceiling is here and this guy could have a ceiling way higher and it's slightly more expensive, but not crazy more expensive. So we're going to go with that guy. And then, you know, you never find that ceiling. And Matt Polster gives you exactly what you know he is. Like that to me is like a prime example of good MLS roster building versus like bad MLS roster building.
And to be fair, there aren't a ton of those guys, you know, those guys are hard to find. They're not growing on trees, right? And some teams do value them. Even the teams that don't have a lot of them, they're hard to get.
Sure.
Right?
But so, I think we've seen teams.
Just to be fair,
they're hard to get, but they are gettable. Like we're seeing that there are guys who are no longer a fit in one team that become a really good fit in another team. And sometimes they're lower priced players. Like you look at Colorado as an example of guys who have found deals versus higher price, right? Sometimes you have to go pay for Mark Anthony Kay.
Yeah, Georgie Mihaljevic.
Georgie Mihaljevic in Montreal.
Good example.
Like, sometimes you're paying $1 million, but you're saying, okay, what would it cost me to get Georgie Mihaljevic from Serbia versus the Georgie Mihaljevic from Chicago? Well, probably a lot more than $1 million in GAM, you know? And
yeah. And by the way, Paul, that's a deal that probably both of us need to like eat a little crow on, because we were saying that was a great deal.
I've thought about that
at the time. And how could you pay Georgi Mihaljevic that much money? So, you know, that's credit to Montreal for pulling that one off.
I've thought about that. I don't know why I was thinking about this last night before I went to bed, but for some reason I was thinking about Georgi Mihaljevic. I think it's because I saw the tweet with
because you're demented.
I saw a tweet
from
Nacho Piatti congratulating Georgi Mihaljevic. That's why. And I still think the Fire did the right thing. It was very clear that relationship was not working.
Yeah,
out.
I agree.
He needed a change to
sometimes
reach that
things
level,
run their course.
And they got
yeah.
the best compensation that they could get from him, you know, and sent him to Montreal.
But we thought Montreal overpaid. Yeah, we're not so much criticizing
sure.
the
well,
Fire
all in,
for
well, all in for
a
sure.
deal.
I thought with the $1 million and the $700,000 salary that you know he wanted to make. What did he? I didn't even look at what he ended up on his new deal. $651,000. I'm sure that'll increase over the course. The base salary is 600 to start. So, yeah, I mean, credit to them to say we'll pay that and we think it's worth it, you know. And, you know, same with Mark Anthony Kay in Colorado. I mean, there are numerous examples, but like I, you know, right now I'm kind of doing that exercise myself of looking around the league. And I actually know a GM who keeps a whiteboard, a rotating whiteboard of players whose minutes are decreasing or who has seemingly like out of favor or are coming towards the end of a contract and is circling those players saying, okay, I'm going to have a conversation to see, are they tradable? You know, what's the cost? Are they going to be free agents soon? I'm kind of going through the same thought process. And I think, you know, I think there are certain teams who make that in their entire offseason thought process. It's starting to pay off more than it did in the past. And probably because the player pool has gotten better over the last few years. And so some of these players who are getting rotated out, Sam, I know you have a hard disagree with that notion, but I think some of these players who start to get kind of naturally rotated out of one team are good fits for another. Diego Rubio, a good example, who was like a really good fit in Colorado. He was kind of getting rotated out in Kansas City. You know, I think you can find those deals because you're not paying anything for a lot of these players, you know, and make up for a lack of budget elsewhere.
One thing really stood out to me when I was looking at these numbers, and this is a piece that I'm hoping to collaborate with some folks on in turn for next week, but just kind of to get at the idea of efficiency of spend and how much bang for the buck are MLS teams getting relative to teams in other leagues, right? And my hypothesis is that MLS teams are spending enough money both on wages and transfer fees that the quality of play should be higher than it is. And I'm hoping to be able to prove that with some data next week. We'll see. I've got something in the works. I don't know if it's going to come to fruition exactly or not. But I'm curious to dive deeper into that. And that's the thing that really stuck out to me is that MLS teams are spending money. And, you know, Paul, you and I advocate on this show quite a bit for MLS teams to spend more, right? And if you want to be a league of choice, you have to. And I think that's true, but I also think there is another truth in this league. And that other truth is that the money that is being spent can be spent better, you know, and for how much money is being spent, things should be better. And I think the reason that they're not is partly for reasons that we've touched on already. I think part of it is some negotiation. Part of it is maybe some bad scouting. Part of it is not every transfer is going to hit. But I think a lot of it is just the structure of the league itself. And all of the different buckets, in particular the DP rule. And I think the DP rule is really, like, I think it's run its course, man. Like, I think it's kind of ridiculous. And I'm curious to dive in more on that in particular and just kind of how much teams are getting in terms of production for their designated players, for how much they're spending. Because we talked about it, that top 10 list of highest paid players, it's not delivering hardly anything for their respective teams this year. And that's a huge portion of the money that's being spent by these clubs. And it's just like not, I mean, I don't know.
It's not going to change.
I don't think it's ever really going to change, but I wish it did. I think there, you know, we've done this before. We've done the exercise of how we would design it if we could start from scratch. And yeah, I don't think we're going to get there, but it'd be cool. It'd be cooler if we did. Anyway. You have anything to add to that, or should we take a break and then go to some questions?
I don't know if that was like a shout out to your Matthew McConaughey interview or not. It'd be cooler if you did, man.
It was.
Thanks
for picking up on that.
You're welcome. Not going to change anytime soon. But we appreciate it, Sam.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you. Stay with us.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we are back, Allocation Disorder, talking about the latest MLS salary dump. We're going to get to some listener questions on this subject, and we're going to start with Steve Fenn, who I meant to mention earlier in the show. He put out something really cool on Twitter the other day when these numbers came out. It's a bizarre chart that I'm not really smart enough to read, but the title is MLS is not an oligarchy. There's little relationship between wages and results. So that conversation we had last segment about how the top wage teams, wage spenders in the league are not doing so well, that's something that historically has been the case in MLS. And so you should go check out this tweet. Maybe I'll retweet it and you can kind of see it there. But basically what it says is high wages, good results. Every season for every team dating all the way back to 2007. It's a pretty even distribution between high wages and good results, high wages and average results, and high wages and bad results. It's 36 with good results, 27 seasons with okay results, and 27 with bad results. Similar story on the other end of the spectrum with low wages and the corresponding results. So go check out that graph. It's interesting. So take a peek at it. Steve's question. What effect would buying out a player have on a club's salary cap and other roster mechanisms? For example, if FC Dallas bought out Frank O'Hara this winter, would they stretch out the remaining cap hit across some number of years, erase it entirely, or only free up DP in international spots? Paul, this one's pretty straightforward.
Sure, like you said, it's pretty straightforward. A buyout is a buyout, so it is essentially cap relief. You've bought out
that. And when it happens in the offseason, it doesn't count against the cap.
Correct. When the offseason buyout happens, you are paying the player their full amount due, and it does not count on your cap. You only get to use that once, but that's how it works. And you do get up the free up the DP and international spots. So a good example would be what happened in Miami, what happened in LA with Giovanni Dos Santos. You pay the player the money that's due, or you negotiate some certain buyout with said player if you think you have leverage to do so, and then that player no longer counts on your cap. It's not an issue of having to spread out the spend over the life of the remaining deal. It's just you've paid off. But of course, if you have future years of that contract, you're not just buying out 1 year of the deal. You have to negotiate how much you're buying out that player, however many years may be left on the contract.
Basically, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card from the cap perspective. And I shouldn't say get-out-of-jail-free. It's a get-out-of-jail-for-millions-of-dollars card. But basically, if they bought out Hara, it wouldn't affect... He would no longer be on their budget, and that space would be freed up. Moving on. Next question from MFT on Twitter. Given the pretty minor spread in overall budgets, and just to add to MFT here, basically, he's saying that most teams in MLS are within a few million dollars of each other in payroll. So given the pretty minor spread in overall budgets, differentiations between clubs are clearly around coaching, staffs, and academies. Any data on coaching or staff budgets around the league? No specific data there, but we can kind of give our educated guesses and reported kind of handiwork on that front. It's basically what you would expect. The highest spending teams also spend the most on that stuff too, for the most part.
With some exceptions, Miami was a good exception there for a while. Though they've built out it's one thing to have, like, Miami had multiple people in their front office, but a lot of these teams that are spending a significant amount of money also have huge international scouting budgets, or much bigger, where they have multiple people based around the world who are scouting people in person. I think that makes a huge difference when it comes to international signings.
Yeah, it does.
Same with Academy.
LAFC is one of those. Yeah,
Toronto.
So LAFC, Toronto, they spend a lot in these areas. Atlanta spends a lot in these areas. NYCFC, through their affiliation with City Football Group, has a huge advantage in this stuff. Red Bull, actually, is maybe an exception in terms of a team that doesn't spend much on salaries but does spend in the other areas, or is able to tap into the other areas through its kind of parent company.
No, but if we go further down, you could say on academy spending, Philadelphia and Dallas far outpace many other MLS teams
for sure.
Their academy spend, which is, you know, that's what their model is based around. And so when it comes to residential academies or number of academy scouts, having a head of academy scouting, things like that don't exist other places, you know, there are MLS teams who allocate their spend in that way versus allocating it towards international scouting. So, you know, there is a mix there. But yeah, I would agree with what you're saying, that typically the highest spending teams overall are spending the most on their backroom staff and on their scouting budgets, and occasionally on the academy. I'm not, like, for example, I don't think the LA Galaxy are outspending many teams on their academy comparatively to how they're outspending them on their first team roster. Like, they've traditionally allocated much more resources towards the first team than the academy, and we've seen that play out over how many players they've brought in. Now, that started to change in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years. There was like that slight little blip with Anolfo where they tried to bring a bunch of academy players into the first team. That lasted like 12 games or however long Anolfo got before he got fired.
Literally.
But outside of that, you know, so there's all these different strategies we can look at. But I think, again, we'll hold up the model franchises. You know, even though Toronto's had a bad year, Toronto and Seattle have been kind of the two clubs that have spent the most period in their transfer fees and their players, but also in the backroom staff. Like, they both,
I don't think
they
that's
both
true
put a ton of resources
Seattle.
Into. Oh, come on, man. I know Seattle likes to play like they don't spend money, but they put resources into their data analytics, into sports science, into scouting.
They spend on those areas. Zero argument. Zero argument there. But when you look at the wages, they're not, I don't think they've been in the top five for a few years, you know? So anyway, not that they're not spending money. They obviously are, but they're not like
again,
top,
specific
top,
to backroom
top
spending, specific to scouting and staff, as this question is asking about. I think Seattle and Toronto have had the best operations, the most number of people, the most attention paid and budget given to. And I think, and this is a really important thing, Sam, that I've kind of prevented myself, thankfully, from ranting about on Twitter. But a part of this is also utilizing that knowledge when you have it. So, like, when we talk about, like, having a scouting department or having domestic knowledge in your organization, like, it's easy to be like, well, look at Ernst Tanner. He's, like, an international signing. Well, like, Ernst Tanner had significant amount of domestic resources around him and valued it and used it. That matters. You know, Losada is an international coach with the longest tenured general manager in MLS who values and pays attention to the value of domestic players in the league. So using those resources matters. And I think Seattle and Toronto have been the best examples traditionally of not just having an analytics department, but putting a lot of value on it, not just having sports science, but putting a lot of value into it. And I interviewed Garth Lagerwey. He talked about their DP process taking months and months and months because they want everyone on board before they make a DP signing. That matters. Using the knowledge that you build around you, not just having it there, is important.
Yeah, it sounds simple, but a lot of teams don't do it as well as they should. Next question, James Porter. I know y'all, it's not a word I say very often, would rather have owners be able to spend what they want. But if you had to pick one thing of these two things that he's about to list to help MLS close the gap with League MX, would you A, rather add a fourth designated player, or B, add enough money so that each team could sign 2 to 3 more TAM level players? I know my answer, and it's B, and with a bullet.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've made it clear in the first two segments that we're both B people here. Spread out the spend over more of the roster.
We're B-boys. This one from Elliot McKinley. David Akam and Miguel Nazarid are listed as having a combined $1.9 million guaranteed compensation. These are both players that are rostered to Nashville and both out on loan. How do players out on loan hit an MLS team's cap, especially big money guys where there's no way that their loan club is paying the full salary? I can't remember this off the top of my head. Can you? This is where some show prep would have helped.
Whatever the loan team is paying is what gets taken off the budget hit. So if, you know, $400,000 of David Akam's salary is being picked up, then $400,000 of David Akam's salary is off of your budget. And the rest is probably paid down with general allocation money. Or they've created room in it and you know, for that cap hit. But yeah, just because you loan them out doesn't mean you get salary cap.
Full relief.
The relief comes from however much actual relief you get in the loan.
For sure. This one from Brian Costall. What's the early read on young money players? I think it's kind of what we said off the bat, right? Is that these guys, this could be something of a money pit, and not all of these guys are going to hit. And even, you know, we're not going to know if they're going to hit for a while, right? So some of the guys that are going to come good haven't come good yet, and we don't know who those guys are. I'm trying to think who the top young U22 signing in the league is so far this year, but not too many of them have really hit the ground running for the most part, Paul. And we don't have a list in front of us here, so, you know, we're going to have a hard time kind of remembering some guys. But yeah, I think it's mostly been
maybe a speculative in Atlanta.
Yeah, he's been up and down, though, and I think it's mostly been a speculative kind of thing, and there haven't been a ton of huge successes, but some of them might come good here over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe more.
Yeah, so and that's what we said. This isn't a one-year thing. There's not going to be an early read. It's because these players are all going to progress at different paces. Some might come in and hit the ground running. I think many, many more are going to take a year or two at least to develop, and sometimes longer. Look at Barco as a great example of a player who came in with a ton of hype, significant expectations at a very young age, and it's taken him 4 years to start to have a much bigger impact. And even then, you know, people will say it's not enough of an impact considering the spend, but young players take time. And that's going to be the big, 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 big question mark around young money. Will they be given that time? And will the fan bases appreciate that necessary patience?
The actual answer to my question about which young money players have done the best, they're probably the ones that have been grandfathered in that were signed in previous years. You know, like Julian Araujo is a U22 player now.
Right.
He's pretty good. So that's probably the answer to that question. Little bit of a cheat code though. This one from Brendan Price. Does Don Garber have a problem with the New York teams not spending real money? Well, first of all, New York City FC is like, they're spending plenty of money. They're just not spending it on players that you've heard of before. So they've changed their model, right? They're not signing Pirlo and Lampard and David Villa, but they are, you know, sixth in payroll right now. And they're spending money on transfer fees as well, particularly on those young money guys or even younger DPs. So they're spending money. So we can eliminate them from that question. The Red Bulls, it's a different story. They are 26th out of 27 teams in the league in payroll. They're spending a little bit of money on transfer fees, but not that much. They signed Patrick Lamala. What was that, Paul? Like $4 million-ish? Yeah, $4 million or so. So that's not nothing. You know, a lot of teams have never spent that much money on a transfer in their history. So that's relatively significant. But they don't spend much overall on their roster. Does Don Garber have a problem with it? I don't know. I'm not inside his head. I have a bit of a problem with it personally, but that's just me.
I mean, it's hard. What do you say to Red Bull? You know, they had Thierry Henry and that whole crew for a long time. People weren't coming out to Red Bull Arena. Then they went very heavy based.
I mean, you don't have to spend on Thierry Henry or Rafa Marquez. No, I'm not even saying the attendance argument, but like they could spend middle tier, you know, in MLS and actually feel the more competitive team and still have the Red Bull model and still do the same thing that they're doing, just with slightly better players across the board.
Yeah. I am always an advocate for team spending more. I agree that Red Bull, when you look at what's happened at Salzburg, Red Bull New York could definitely be that, and probably more because they're in New York. They could probably attract better players than Red Bull Salzburg can, though Salzburg has champions.
Not anymore.
So it's probably not. Yeah. But like Salzburg when they started the project in Salzburg, yeah. You know? And so I think they could absolutely spend more. Certainly, I think Don Garber recognizes that they have a major problem in this league in having the lack of support that they want and desire from the New York market, from the Chicago market. They're not maximizing some of the biggest markets in this country, Houston, Dallas. That's a problem that the league knows, that they've acknowledged. That
it's a massive problem. Yeah, it's a big one.
So
that's it, like, it's a massive problem.
I don't know if it's about spending money or if it's about finding ways to connect in those markets, but they certainly know that those markets are trouble spots in a big way for MLS.
And I would assume that he has a much bigger problem with Red Bull than with City, personally. I think New York City does more to market itself, not that they do a ton, and they have at least the magic bullet on the, I don't want to say on the horizon, but they have some grand possibility out there of a stadium at some point, however nebulous it might feel and seem. They can always say, well, if we get a stadium, things will change. Red Bull can't say that. They have a stadium. They can't say that. So I would imagine that he's probably more concerned with that team. Last one, and this is from an user who wishes to remain anonymous, who is curious about the trend of the median and average salaries going down for the league. There was a slight dip in both of those between April and September. We didn't cover that already. Any thoughts on that, or just a one-year drop? Yeah, I don't really see that as a trend, Paul. I don't know about you. I don't know if it'll go up next year because the salary cap is flat again, right? So it'll probably be about the same. But I don't think that's anything really to be too concerned about for the future. Anything different from your end?
No, my guess is it's CBA related. You know, the cap stayed flat, contracts didn't, harder decisions were made in some places. You had to move guys on maybe you wouldn't have because of the increases in salary, and that's probably what it's attributable to. And I would expect, to your point, Sam, that remains the same going into next year. So those trends might stay very similar. But, you know, I don't think it's a sign of a bigger trend. Though, if my theory is correct, that the higher numbers are going to disappear, those numbers will keep dropping. So we'll see.
Well, maybe. I mean, if you have more $3 million, I don't know.
Well, I guess if it's math, the median, we're not math, yeah, it's people. Not, you know, obviously, I'm not a stats guy. I don't even want to tell you what my stats grade was at Northwestern when they forced me to take stats. Wasn't great.
I want to we'll know see. It.
I think it's attributable to the CBA negotiations.
What was your grade?
And the flat salary cap. And tell that, us. My friend, will end the episode right there.
No way, no dude. Problem. You got to tell us.
I don't got to do anything.
Tell us. I'm not
I
letting
not
you off
have
this
to do
hook.
Anything. I'm sorry.
You're not the one that ends the show. That's not how this works, Paul. Paul's a coward. He's not going to tell us our grade. I will end the show by saying that I enjoyed a pack of Dunkaroos this weekend. They were fantastic, and now I'm seeing them everywhere. Thanks for listening to Allocation Disorder. Go try some Dunkaroos. They're delightful. I'm Sam. He's Paul. We'll be back next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.